everyone is a star child, made of stardust and the infinite potential of the universe. This extraordinary, fearless something in each of us clamors for freedom from the bonds of fear, conformity, and an ordinary life. Welcome to Dr. Durr's Living in the Sweet Spot, where practical tools and solutions from the intersection of mind-body medicine, science, and spiritual well-being awaken and empower you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. Hi there. I am your host, Dr. Balan A. Durr. I'm here in the sweet spot where I have conversations with my guest about mental wealth defined as the essential importance of brain health plus transformative thinking to assist you in demonstrating your greatest infinite potential. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming my dear friend and business partner, who is really an extraordinary individual because he brings to the platform a unique business experience, but also that of an artist. And just tremendous experience that he also has a unique perspective where he approaches things and combines things in a way that you would never expect for a business person. And I just thought his unique perspective would be just a wonderful, informative contribution. So let me go ahead and bring him in. Again, my dear friend and business partner, Frank Goss III.
Hi, hey there.
Hey there.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, you know what? It is always an absolute pleasure, you know, when we get to have these conversations. And again, you have, again, what I call a uniquely extraordinary perspective and creativity that you bring to, you know, your projects. And even to the work that I'm doing and that we've collaborated on. So again, I'm really glad to have you here today. So we can have more of those conversations and share that right with our the audience.
Oh no, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And same here. And, you know, again, a few weeks ago, I had John W. Fountain on the platform with me to have the conversation. And, you know, he brings all this tremendous, you know, award-winning journalist and all these other things. And similarly, you know, you have an MBA. You actually were a clothing designer, even as a teen, right? Selling gear, you know, out of boutiques at that time. And then, you know, you went on to, you know, be an international banker. And then obviously now an entrepreneur. And so again, that, you know, unique combination of experience and talent and gift, like him, I think, you know, makes you a beautiful masterpiece in the soul of a man. So again, I'm just glad to have you here.
That's a nice thing to say. Thank you.
Oh, you're more than welcome. You're more than welcome. So you know what? I think maybe it would be useful for our conversation about business today, you know, to talk about that, because again, you started off as an artist. And one of the things I, you know that you said was you made the decision to go in banking because of structure and some of the other things that you thought that would bring, those business skills would bring to what you were doing as a designer. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
Okay. Well, I born and raised on the west side of Chicago, and went to Marshall High School. So in high school, I had the, you know, the hustle bug, meaning, you know, it was a challenging experience. So My mother was sixth grade education up from the south part of the migration process, and trying to live on the west side, which is really from an economic perspective, is a lot of people from the migration came there, and they're either single parent or not well educated. But the point is that I discovered in high school that I had this creative talent, and I started designing clothes. My brother could draw, so I started drawing. So with that, the principal of the school kind of realized that I started designing clothing, and they let me back then. The wear, the fashion was dashiki. So we had sewing classes. So I had a little business in school where we sewed dashikis, and then I got hired at a boutique to work as a designer. The managers of the boutique liked what I drew, and then they brought me on as a teenage designer. So I designed clothing lines then. And one thing I discovered as I moved, towards the graduated from high school and going to college, is I knew very little bit about business, and they were, making money. Meaning most of the stuff that I would design, the clothing lines usually sold out, and I got very, very little money from them, or I got what they wanted to give me. So it was that lack of knowledge that I decided that, you know what, designing is great, but I need to know what's business, what is this all about. So that's really sparked the beginning of me really s deciding to move down a different pathway, away from creative things, to trying to understand, what business is about, what the economy was about. What was this game that adults were playing that I didn't really have a clue. I
No, I'm
changed
sorry.
to
I'm laughing because you said, "What's this game that adults are playing that I don't have a clue?" And I think that is a hugely important point, right? How you gonna win if you don't even know what the game is or the rules?
absolutely correct. So I instead of going to the Art Institute, I went to end up going to Roosevelt University, and I won the Ford Foundation scholarship. And I decided to go into economics, which was I ran, I ran across I took an economics class, and this guy was, just really insightful, articulate, kind of explained things, and I was like, oh, then it started, really sinking in that, oh, this is what all of this is about. This, and then I start understanding that I wasn't being paid appropriately. So, but that's another story. But the whole point is, I got my bachelor's degree in economics from Roosevelt. Didn't decide to stay on for a couple of other bachelor's degrees in finance and business administration. And then I ran across an incredible Black woman named Challis Lowe. Love her to death. She worked at Continental Bank, which was, had a 100-year plus history and was a multinational bank. And she was in HR, and she wanted to create some bring diversity to the money center of the bank, the treasury of the bank, because it had virtually no Blacks in it at all. And in one of the most crucial positions, which was called the money desk, which managed the bank checking account and its funding activity, she wanted to put a Black person in there. And then when she saw my background and she had a conversation with me, She says, are you up for a challenge? I said, yeah, absolutely. She says, I'm going to put you in a very, very challenging area. You're going to run across some very, she was very blatant. She said, some very racist people who won't want you there, but I think you can make it. She says, I've interviewed quite a few folk, and I want to put a black person in there, and I think you're the one that can make it. Now, can you do that? And I was just like, okay. But I was looking at her as well as interviewing other places, and then I said, this might be something that I really want to do, and also that will give me more of a macro view of economic activity. So I took the challenge. So from there, I worked there for, end up running the money desk, went through all the racial issues, of, the discrimination, da da da, all that. But there in those in markets, it's performance. It doesn't matter what color you are. If you're making money for the bank, they're gonna keep you. So I end up being
So on a real,
promoted
so on
and.
a really, on a really fundamental level, because we're going to get into this a little bit later, but I think, as important as race is in this country, that I think the real issue is about resources. And so to me, I tell people the real color that matters is the color green. And so, resources is about, whether it's housing, whether it's, money in terms of loans, whether it's education, whether it's, again, how, what it, whatever it is, it's about accessing a resource. So the color that really matters is the color green. And people's color then becomes a way to identify you as not like me, and therefore I don't want to have you want you to have access to resources.
Yeah, that's true. Not having not well, knowledge is power. So, learning about monetary policy, learning about international monetary policy, has been very influential in me moving through my career. So I, did that. Became the kind of the first black, young black pre vice president at Continental in the Treasury Department, running the money desk. I actually ran the bank's checking account, which was $30 billion a day back in the 70s and 80s. $30 billion was a lot of money then.
It's a lot of
I had
money
10,
now.
I had 10 money traders reporting to me, and then I got promoted to international after my 5th year because they didn't. Continental was on an expansion of opening banks around the world. I opened up the branch in Puerto Rico, and then I corrected, straightened out the branch in Toronto, and then they sent me to the Middle East. I opened up our branch in Bahrain at the time. And then they gave me all 19 branches to do the I became the international funding manager for all 19 branches, and I did that for about 6 years. And then I decided I want to change the pace. I hit the glass ceiling, and then I moved on to be an international lending officer for a year. And then I, after hitting the glass ceiling, I moved up. I resigned and then moved on to I decided to jump back into creativity, and then open up a jazz club in the middle of downtown. And during the time that I opened it, everyone was saying that a jazz club would not work targeting primarily middle class blacks, and I completely disagree with that. Went ahead and opened it, and it became extremely successful. That was the first club I did, was called Close Up Piano Bar. So did that several years, and then after that, decided that I wanted to get into technology. I sold that, and then went on to work for Lucent Technologies for 10 years. and I became the chief operating officer for the their indirect channel, which was about a billion plus. Did that, and then did that for 10 years, and then bounced right back into creativity because at that time it loosened, sold off that division, and it became Avaya, which that's what it is now. And then I went into again back into jazz clubs and then festivals and then some consulting work. So
and let's not forget your documentary, right?
I did a short term documentary. I did a short film documentary called The Future of Jazz, and it won the Las Vegas Film Festival. So I dibbled and dabbled a little bit into that, and then now I'm
Your first documentary entered the first time into a film festival, and you win that category. You know, to talk about black excellence. I'm just saying, just overall with you, right? Black excellence.
Well, I mean, it was you know, surrounded by great people. You know, we put a team together, and right in the middle of doing festivals, we were lucky. We worked hard to do it, and it turned out extremely well. And because of that, now I'm back in the festival business. I'm working on the, I gave the first Bronzeville Neighborhood Jazz Festival. That's the name of it. And now we're going in our second year. And then by the way, that's when you and I start working together. It's an unusual jazz festival in the sense that the MC is a psychiatrist, which is not only are they getting a wonderful experience in terms of, you know, enjoying themselves, but they're also learning some things about mental health. And I think you brought in a very, very interesting angle to a festival. And a lot of people, as you saw after you got off the stage, people were following you back to the VIP booth, buying your book and just, you know, pouring their hearts out about personal issues.
Yeah. So, you know what? So I want to get into that because number one, as I've mentioned, when you and I, you know, reconnected, I think it was back in 2017, although we met back in the 90s, you know, and I was
yeah, you came to one of my clubs. That's when I met you. You were with a television anchor called Art Norman, and you were in medical school.
Yes, I was in medical school, and I think you
with
know
with a daughter. With a daughter, let's not mention that. I mean,
a single parent
going through medical school. That just shows you what Black women can do.
Yes, mindset, tenacity, will, right? Determination, yes.
Everybody else told you you couldn't do it, that's the other part of that piece.
Well, just a couple people. Only a couple people.
They question your decision, let's put it that way.
Well, absolutely, especially in light of the fact that you know, I was made a decision to become a single parent and knowing I wanted to go to medical school. So, you know, of course, retrospectively, I questioned it too, crazy as hell. But because, you know, I knew it was going to be difficult, but I didn't know it was going to be as difficult as it is, right? And the fact of the matter is, fortunately for me, you know, some people, you know, might call it stubbornness, but it's when I commit to doing something, you know, there were, I'm going to get it done. And there were days when, you know, when I sat down and I cried, right? But then you're going, okay, pull it back together because I got to keep it moving. Right. So you're in here now and I'm not going to quit.
As opposed to quitting.
That yeah, right. But I'm just saying, but my thing is I'm in here now, figure it out, make it work, make it happen, get it done, because I'm not quitting. That was my own approach with myself. So, you know, and I've had people tell me, you tough. Yeah, I am, but that's because I'm tough with myself, but it's also kind of how I grew up, which, you know, back, you know, and actually I want to get into this even with you, you know, back in the day, you know, we had to grow up fighting. I didn't grow up fighting as much as you did, but, you know, I think about how, and that's what I wanted to discuss is how I think how we grew up and how, and especially in your particular case, I mean, both of our mothers who are single mothers valued education. You know, I tell them, you know, my mother, she definitely had a standard of excellence and she never said I had to become anything. But I did always have to, she wanted me to do well. There was always a standard of excellence. And so I wanted to get into how, you know, our backgrounds and how we grew up contribute to our mindset and therefore our demonstration of our potential in the way that we chose to do it. You know, you talk to me about, you know, to your mom who has since transitioned, you know, how much she was a tremendous influence. And, you know, you mentioned that she had a sixth grade education. And, you know, of course, things were so challenging and difficult. And then here's the reason I'm going into this, just say this. I think people will sometimes see people who are successful, but have no idea what they had to go through in order to get to create the success that they have. They'll look at you and assume, you know, I say that, you know, that you have this style and creativity and your sense of being that is ageless. And some people may think that, you know, you just kind of just been like that. Things maybe were handed to you. And the fact of the matter is, you had a very difficult, challenging, you know, childhood, but your mom, and at one point to help the family out, you were going to quit school and your mom was like, no, 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 no. Right.
Correct. No, it's absolutely correct. She's the main reason for everything I've accomplished. Her insight was extremely valuable. And when I thought, you know, the best thing to do to help her and my family, my sister's and brother, was to, you know, quit school and go to work, find work. She saw the value in education. That's why I say, you know, knowledge is power. She was 1,000% correct.
Yes. And so, because she's looking at the long game, right?
Yes.
As opposed to
the short game,
the short-term gain. And why, again, things were very, you know, they were very difficult. You know, I know you shared about just, again, how difficult things were and how you would get, you know, chased home or not, or chased or having to fight or having to avoid fights kind of on a daily basis, you know, growing up on the West Side. So it's, but I think, cause you know, the other thing I call you the peacemaker, right? Cause you right there in the middle in terms of your sibling group. And right. So those experiences both at home and there in the community helped you learn some skills that have been very valuable in your interactions and dealings with people. But I think also, and again, that push to not quit, right? To not quit because you know adversity, you know challenge, you know difficulties, you know, threatening situations. And so learning how to navigate that, and then again, not quitting just because it gets hard. I think, you know, that has been a significant tribute to your mindset, which I wanted to get into, because mindset, in addition to brain health, is the doorway to be able to demonstrate our greatest infinite potential, i.e. have success. So you want to share some more about that?
I think one has to redefine what we all encounter in our daily experience, which is failure. You have to redefine failure. And failure is, you know, some people have failure and they can they quit, they stop. But failure is good for you. I mean, to fail is a wonderful thing, and you need to look at it a completely different way. It is basically you're on the job training and dealing with a specific task, and it's something you learn from. It's a learning process. It's kind of your apprenticeship to getting things done. And then when you look around the world, as we define based on economics, every successful entrepreneur has failed many, 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 many times. But he took that failure as fuel to continue on and adjust based on his feedback. So it's kind of a scientific, it's kind of the scientific method if you look at it from that point of view. So understanding failure and understanding how to learn from failure leads you ultimately to success in accomplishing your goals. So I think there's a certain mindset associated with that. I think the other thing too is...
Before you move past that, I wanted to kind of expound upon that, because I do agree with you that one about when you said it's kind of like the scientific method, right? Because as a physician and author and poet and host and many things, fundamentally, I'm also a scientist, and what you said is absolutely correct. The way I frame it for people is that, you know, the researchers for the cure for cancer, if they were like many of us, they actually would have quit, right? Because it's taken them decades and they're still haven't quote unquote found it. There have been improvements, there have been innovations, et cetera, but they haven't found the cure yet. And so as a scientist, you form a hypothesis, meaning this is what I think is going to happen. You test it out. And then if it doesn't work out, which it often doesn't the first time, or may take you many times, but what you're doing is gathering information to say this worked, or meaning I got this result. If it's the result I don't want, then let me do something different and then making adjustments and doing that. Another way that I frame it in terms of sports, you know, in terms of say with basketball players, because it's March Madness, right?
Absolutely.
So I said, you know, they're out there shooting. They don't quit shooting, right? Just because they miss, they shoot, they miss, they don't stop shooting. What do? They make adjustments to their shot and then they keep shooting. So unfortunately, we don't think of it in such simplistic terms to connect it to the bigger, you know, the bigger objectives in our lives, but it's really the same principle. And so the other thing I think in light of that, it's actually important that we redefine failure. And for me, what I've done to do that in terms of redefining failure is I say that for me, there is no such thing as failure because we are always successful. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is that every time we take an action, we create a result. So therefore, we are always successful. It's just a lot of times we are successful in creating mess we don't want, right? So the thing to do is make a different choice next time, right? Make a different choice, do it differently so that you can get a different result. If you plant apple seeds, you're going to get apples. If you don't want apples, but you want strawberries, then plant strawberries. So do that which is consistent with the result that you want to have. And in the process, believe and trust in yourself that you can learn and that you can figure it out as you go. So I think that that is, while you might not necessarily say it that way, the thing that I've seen you do in that regard, though, is that there's this tremendous belief that you have in your ability to learn and to figure it out, which is why you're always what I call kind of in that process of transformation, always in that process of demonstrating something bigger and grander or more wonderful and uniquely different than what you did before. Is because of those fundamentals.
Yeah, I think one thing everyone has to accept that change is a constant.
Yes.
Right. So yes.
You take a breath in, it's a change. You breathe out, it's a change.
In reality, the society we're living in, the world, with technology and especially the advent of quantum technology, changes the constant. And one of the things, so it's lifelong learning. And I think, whatever you want to be successful in, failure is part of the learning process. And that's the thing you've got to accept, that you failed. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. You learn from that, and then you move on, and you take what you've learned that didn't work and add it to your new plan. So at the margin, so failure combined with adaptation, adapting or changing your game plan, that's how failure works in. You see it in game theory all the time or in actual sports. They start out with a game plan, and if they're losing at halftime, the coaches get back on the drawing board and say, scrap that plan. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to do that. This is what they're doing. We need to change that. And then they come out with a second half, and that's why in the second half, someone can lose in the first half and then win the game after the adjustments. And the adjustments is where – and that's where failure – for you may try something, and it fails – you've got to make the adjustments, given on what you've experienced, to move towards the goal that you're trying to accomplish. And that's true in everything you do in life, and even in relationships, personal relationships, and business relationships. So let me, one of the things that I think that I've learned over time is, in addition to the resource angle that, we talked about kind of previously about the lack of resources. And one of the major reasons why, minority businesses in general have not been as successful or having an on-ramp is because of lack of capital.
Mm-hmm.
So, regardless of whatever the narrative is about, what we're taught in economics is the scarcity principle, but underneath all of that is, they talked about the invisible hand. There is no invisible hand. That's not true.
For those who may not know, what's the invisible hand?
Well, in economic theory, one of the reasons why they say capitalism works is because there's some magical, mystical, invisible hand, and the invisible hand allocates the resources, right? So in a broader, from a macro perspective, looking at the big picture, mm-hmm. The economies, no matter what it is, socialism, fascism, dictatorship, whatever, mm-hmm. it's all about managing millions of people. You know, maybe you have a population of 20 million or 100 million or 300, and in the United States, 380 million. To manage that economy or to manage that, you look at it as a household, is demand and supply. It's the supply of goods and the demand for goods. And when there's more supply than there is demand, the price goes down. When there's more demand than there is supply, the price go up. So the price go up is inflation, the price go down is deflation. So the objective of the people who governs the economy, the managers of the economy, which is our government and the central bank, their objective is to keep demand and supply in balance. When the demand and supply is in balance, prices don't go up and go down, they stay the same.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got 380 million people or 400 million people plus,
mm-hmm.
which is really people come flying in, going out, they measured that price stability in something they call inflation. So the target that the United States today has, and for the last decade or so, is 2% inflation every year.
Mm-hmm.
Prices are not supposed to go beyond 2%. So right now, rates are rising because of that. So that demand and supply of, you know, and it's all these people pursuing making money under the concept of producing goods or providing a service.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a part of the economy.
Yes.
But let me just say that the allocation of those resources within that framework, which is the framework we work in, is based on relationships. It's who you know. That's
yes.
That, you know, all that theory stuff is irrelevant. It's who you know. Most of the people who are millionaires and billionaires, they've had a relationship that turned them on to that opportunity, and they were able to capitalize on the opportunity because they had the skill set and they had access to resources, or they were provided resources. Why is it that, and I'm just oversimplifying, with venture capitalists, right? They don't put a lot of money, you know, there's not a lot of money allocated. That's billions of dollars that venture capitalists own. But they very seldom award any, they have very seldom fund black venues, black entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
White boy out of college can write something on a napkin, mm-hmm. and get $10 million. For a black person to do that, they got to pawn their mom, they got their grandmother, so we don't have access to capital. I mean, you've seen that with in all kinds of things. I mean, even in real estate, when they talk about redlining.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, someone can have a house, an appraiser comes out and appraises it at $500,000, and it'd be a black person, same house,
mm-hmm.
they appraise it at $400,000. So that's some inbred, that's some built-in bias that's in the process, and all of that is relationship-based.
Right, and so to your point, to kind of more deeply define it, the relationship means that you're someone that I know and therefore can trust.
Correct.
And in the trusting part, it then means I'm willing to, and again, if I see you as like me, then I'm willing to let you have access to resources that somebody else, I'm not going to, because you're not like me, I don't know you, and I don't trust you.
So I want to double down on this. I want to say as real simple as a statement, your network of people you know and you meet and you develop a relationship is a major function of your net worth. Your network is a major function of your net worth. Now, let me just say this.
Come on, teach.
I just say that as minorities, as Black people, we've never truly been taught that relationships are your doorway in. Be it college, be it business, be it anything, that some people, because of their relationships, if they need money or they need a loan, they can contact a friend who has a friend at a lending institution. And guess what? They'll walk in the door and the loan is approved. They'll just fill out the paperwork and tell you how to fill it out.
Gotcha.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because of that relationship. So in a large majority of the minority communities is a competitive thing against each other instead of working together.
Mm-hmm.
Like other cultures, the Jewish culture, the Asian culture,
Hispanics.
I mean, you can go down the line, the Latin culture. Mm-hmm. So we did that before we were enslaved. And that part of this whole, 400 years of slavery has caused all these kind of dysfunctional relationships. And I think that that's a key component, because you're not competing. When you get land into a position, wherever you may be, you need to, because of that position, you can develop some really wonderful relationships. It's a wonder. How is a guy, when I was working at the bank, how's a guy can get fired from the bank I work at, and then the next day have a job better than the job he got fired from?
Relationship.
Relationship. He called up his guy and said, hey, you know what? I'm out of work. You have everything? Oh, yeah. You're my guy. Absolutely. I got something for you. Boom. So Black students, Black people, women and men, they need to develop and keep and manage the relationships as they move forward, because you never know in your class who's going to be what.
Right.
Imagine all the people who knew Obama when he was at Harvard, or when he was here in Chicago working, as a community outreach person.
Right.
If you understood the value of relationship, you could have been in the White House. So my narrative is relationships are important. So I have some 30-year, 40-year relationships that I've maintained intentionally, positively, because I know how important relationships is. And so in economics, relationships are everything. Because guess what? The billionaire boys hang together,
yes.
Right? The millionaire boys hang together, right? So when they need to raise money, if they need anything, they can make a phone call, and they got $50 million.
Right.
They got a lot of credit.
Playing golf together, playing tennis together,
But even if you go back further in college, some of your professors are so hooked up, but you're so busy trying to get through class and trying to pass that you don't realize how valuable this guy is sitting in front of you, who's got years of experience and have multiple relationships that you can tap into. That's why people go to certain schools, because the people who go there, their families, and having those relationships will be valuable at some other point in their lives. So my point, back to my point, and you as a psychiatrist know this, relationships are everything. They really, really are. And so, the habit of just throwing away relationships, not caring about them, and trying to get over on someone, trying to, not have integrity and not do what you say and say what you do, that's burning bridges, and that will hurt you in the long run.
Right, because what it says is that you're not reliable, you're not dependable, I can't trust you. You know,
Absolutely.
So, you know, one of the things that's been key in our relationship with each other is that we do what we say we're going to do, and that we say to them, or we tell the other, or we say to the other one, either I can't do that, or I don't want to do that, I want to do this instead. And so that sense of that then sense of trust, right, dependability between us has enabled us to have a great relationship, great connection, because we're not disrupting the relationship and creating disconnection, right?
Yes.
And to your point, I remember sitting in your clubs, watching you, and really kind of astonished then, and even all these many years later, because what I would observe you doing is I would observe you connecting people to other people, meaning, oh, you're interested in that? Let me introduce you to this person. And I was like, it was astonishing, because I had never seen that and to that degree then nor since. And so it was always, again, it was just kind of astonishing to me that you had this sense of connecting people in that way. And, you know, again, you and I had lost, you know, when I graduated from medical school and left the state to go do residency and practice elsewhere. So we lost connection with each other for a number of years. And when I came back, and there was an entrepreneurial class that I was taking, and the teacher started talking about a case study, and I'm listening to him. I'm going, that sounds like Frank. I'm going, he didn't use your name, but I'm just listening to how he was describing the place. And he said, you know, it was a small place, but folks would be jammed in there. And I said, no, you mean cozy. it was cozy. And that was Club UN. So, and then again, he was again talking about how you would introduce people and connect people with similar interests. And so afterwards, after class, I went up and I said to him, I said, you talk about Frank Goss? He said, yeah, that's what I'm talking about, Frank Goss. I said, okay. And so then, of course, you know, that I wouldn't found you, and we reconnected. And to your, again, despite the fact that we had lost touch all those years, we had this value and appreciation for each other's character, but also, you know, I would call it, you know, everybody has their own brilliance, for mine, for you, you for me, what we were attempting to accomplish. And so we treated the relationship with care that enabled it to be sustained over all that time, despite the fact that we didn't have, you know, contact with each other. And then since then, even going forward, that's how we've treated it. So there's that part in terms of the business part. There's also the part in terms of the personal, which then has allowed us to do some of both. And to your point again, the benefit is I have my own brilliance, gifts, and talents. You have your own gifts and brilliance and talents. And then again, with your creativity, you know, then you were saying, well, I'm going to be doing this jazz festival. And the fact is, I see what's happening in our communities and the community at large, how important mental health is for everyone, and people don't understand what they're seeing and observing with families, but I get the importance of it. So, you know, so then let's do this project together where we're going to have smooth jazz. We're going to entertain the people. They're going to have a good time. And while they're enjoying themselves and having a good time, but they can learn some things. So let's have you, because you also know that I've hosted, that let's have you host and then give a message about mental health and empowerment. So again, without lack of relationship, I don't know you, you don't know me, and therefore we can't collaborate, right? Collaborate instead of compete with each other in a way that not only serves us individually, but also benefits the community, benefits the whole, to your point.
Yes. I think it, you know, it's, you know, differentiation. You know, the Bronzeville Neighborhood Jazz Festival, especially in 2022, and now we're going to 2023. It adds so much value to the experience, and people have reacted to that. That, you know, instead of there being a comedian or whatever, some personality, they're getting something that's meaningful for them and their mental health. Because now, you know, given mental health is a real big issue globally, not only nationwide, but globally.
Let me say this, and how can it not be when your body can't live without a brain? Simple facts, right? It's running everything except for a few simple reflexes. So how do you not take care of air traffic control, right? I tell people, a few weeks ago, we had air traffic control go down. You got 3,200 flights grounded, other planes that are forced to redirect to land someplace else. You know, you have a where somebody directs one plane to land on the same runway as another one's about to take off. But fortunately, one of the pilots about to land sees it and diverts. That's the kind of stuff that happens when your brain doesn't work. Either something about the way you think, feel, behave, or the way your body functions, it's going to glitch, go down, not work, go sideways, way left when your brain doesn't work. So it's your brain health is extremely important.
Yeah. So that's why it's been a very important value added proposition. Who knows where it's going to lead in terms of people emulating what we started. The other thing I want to talk about just briefly that we covered and what's,
and I just want to make sure people know. So there's the one we're doing this year is going to be August 5th,
which is the first Saturday in August. It's from 12 noon to 9 p.m. At King Drive, 38th and King Drive and 37th and King Drive, two blocks, and then 38th Street from King Drive to Rhodes.
Yeah, in Chicago.
Yeah, Chicago,
yes. Lamar.
And, you know, the main thing, it's free admission, free parking. There's going to be a lot of giveaways. We also, this year, is going to be giving has to do with cryptocurrency. So you'll get a free NFT and wallet if you attend, for every person that attends. So we're doing some innovative things. And I think it'll be, as far as festival goes, it'll be a very, very unique, wonderful experience. And it's a lot of, you know, we have four incredible acts, jazz acts, contemporary jazz. So everyone should definitely put it on their calendar to come out.
Absolutely. Have a good time. Enjoy yourself and learn some things, right? Yes.
Absolutely. I wanted to backtrack on something about relationships, because I a large part of this piece has been talking about relationship. And so some people don't. So you have to know how to manage relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the key premises that you have to follow, I think that's valuable in terms of following, is the notion of one, and not being competitive, meaning in not being competitive, and two, and implicit in not being competitive is you thinking you're always right. So you have to have the ability to say, I'm wrong. And you have to have you have to pursue truth. You have to pursue truth. Now, everybody has a computer in their hand with their phone.
Yes.
So you can easily find out truth. And when you're wrong, you have to say, I was wrong. And there's nothing wrong with saying you're wrong, because here's what's really the undercore of all this. What's true and right is good for both of you.
Mm.
But if you're on this, I've got to be right all the time, the decision process, the decision tree is, it'll be good for you and bad for the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes a competitive narrative. And then also, there are times when you both may be right. And so you've got to learn, put these things in your vocabulary. You're right, I'm wrong. Thank you for saying that. Or can we respectfully disagree and leave it at that and move on?
Yes, because that's
there are no grudges. Mm-hmm. There's no none of that.
Yes.
The point is the relationship is growing and you both respect each other and you're following these fundamental principles. And that's how you maintain a relationship for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, for a lifetime, if both of you follow those basic principles. Let's go through them again. We respectfully disagree.
Yes.
And you leave it. You don't carry it as luggage like, you know, I was right. There aren't no grudges. And when you're wrong, admit it. There's nothing wrong for a man or a woman to be wrong. And here's another fundamental principle. We're equivalent. There's no, you know, men are more superior than women or women more. Listen, we're equivalent. Let's be real about this. No one has a choice of sex, race, or the time they were born. So we're all equal. So yes, if you have those basic fundamentals of relationship, and we're talking about relationship management, because relationship management, not only personally, family-wise,
mm-hmm,
and in business, because everything is relationship management in your life. Everything is relationship management. If you manage relationships the right way, you will get the outcome you want.
Yes.
And those are the fundamental things that you gotta, because it's a lot of people have the principle, it's my way or the highway. I ain't trying. And also, let me just say one other important principle.
Because we're going to have to wrap here. This is a great conversation, but we got to wrap.
Okay, this is really easy. And you're going to be surprised at what this other principle is. Learn how to listen. Listening is an art form.
Yes, because you know what? So a couple of things just really quickly. You know, our dear good friend, Anthony Williams, Tony Williams, who I call Master Yoda, one of his famous quotes of mine that he says, when you talk, you can only talk about what you know. You can't learn nothing new. So the importance of listening. Two, I think the other thing from a egoic standpoint is that instead of saying I'm wrong, which means I, the person, am wrong, is that you say, you know, my conclusion is wrong, right? And so it kind of takes it off of, because we all come up with the wrong conclusions at some point in time. And then, then the other part is just like you said, is, you know, cause and you and I do this one, I think we both bring an intention of peace to the relationship. And that guiding principle, amongst some others, when we disagree with each other, then we'll, you know, one of us will pull the energy down, and somebody will say we agree to disagree. So I think those were amazing points. I think it was an amazing point that you made about the huge importance of networking, but connecting it to network. So you said your network is a function of your net worth. Fabulous, fabulous. And so I just, you know, you know, obviously I wanted to thank you for you appearing. Of course, you're wonderful. We always have fabulous conversations. In this last minute, is there something that you want to share with people, ways to connect with you? Carry us out.
Yeah. I'm producer of the Bronzeville Neighborhood Jazz Festival. So if you you can reach out to me there, the 2023, and also published a book called the Handbook for All Professionals, which is a handbook and a workbook. So you know, I'm Frank Goss III.
And it's a great book, right? One of the things you say in the book is, now you got the job, you put all this work into getting the job. What are you prepared to do in order to keep the job? Because it's yours to lose. Bingo. Come on, somebody.
Bingo, absolutely true.
Yes, so great book.
So, yeah, you can read. You know, I'm on Facebook, so you can obviously reach out to me. And again, Doc, thank you so much for having me on the program. I hope we were able to provide some insight, and those are helpful tools that'll help you with anything you're trying to accomplish in life.
Oh, absolutely. So again, I want to thank you for being, you know, having this conversation with me today, and sharing again your own brilliance with myself and the audience. Greatly appreciate you. And as we do, we're gonna push the pause button, and we'll pick up another time, because again, you always have this tremendous wealth of knowledge and wisdom. And with that, I want to thank everyone for joining us. I am your host, Dr. Valen A. Durr, awakening and empowering you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. Thank you for joining us today in the sweet spot. Share, follow, and like us on social media. To learn more, please visit valinadurmd.com, spelled valinadurmd.com. Join us next week, and remember, when you heal your mind, all things are possible.